Hello and welcome to the Miko Bits Show, and I'm your host, Miko Bits, and today I have an exciting guest. It's Barney from Vega Protocol, and Vega Protocol is in the derivative space, but in terms of the deep innovation they're providing, it's really quite to the exchange area, and obviously dealing with really interesting liquidity solutions, so it's very exciting. I think, as with all of my shows, it is a information and entertainment show. It's not investment advice, so we may talk about things that can be purchased, like cryptographic assets, but, you know, definitely seek a licensed professional. The other kind of, like, disclosure for me is that my fund, Gumi Cryptos Capital, is invested in Vega, but, you know, I don't let that color my you know, opinion too much. Obviously, I think it's a great project on that basis. So I guess without further ado, here's Barney. Hi.
Hi, Miko. Great to be here.
Yeah, welcome to the show. So, you know, I guess jumping right into the meat of it, like, you know, can you tell us the problem that's solved by Vega?
Yeah, so I spent most of my career in the sort of traditional financial world building trading systems and working with traders, and got super excited when Bitcoin came along and Ethereum as well, and sort of did some mining and got in a very small way on the Ethereum presale. And I was really excited to kind of decentralize finance. And, you know, before DeFi was DeFi, I was excited by that idea. And I looked into kind of, you know, doing some of the things that I'd done around building derivatives protocols. And what I realized very quickly was that Ethereum is an incredibly constrained environment. And effectively, with Ethereum DeFi, you're trying to build these sophisticated products that need risk management and margins and all of that stuff on what is effectively like a kind of pocket calculator. And that just means that you make some really big trade-offs that in my view and you know, our company's view, certainly mean that DeFi derivatives aren't sort of built on Ethereum are never going to be kind of accepted in the real world use cases, because they won't be efficient enough in terms of capital, they won't be efficient enough in terms of pricing, and often they may not even be able to offer the same features as the kind of traditional finance equivalents. And so what we were looking to do when we created Vega was to create something that was effectively optimized for the ground up as kind of a scaling layer for derivatives. So, you know, building an application specific chain that could optimize derivatives for the decentralized web. So providing a layer, and Vega actually plugs into Ethereum and right now and in future other blockchains like Terra and Polkadot and others. But, you know, providing that derivatives layer, so you take the same assets, you know, your DAI, your Ether, your ERC20s, but are able to kind of, you know, move them onto this supercharged trading layer and start creating and trading derivatives without some of those constraints. And that's really what Vega provides.
Yeah, it's obviously a topic of huge excitement. You know, it's a very big issue, you know, and I think that when you look at the kind of fundamental design of exchange systems, you know, you really have this kind of centralized, you know, central limit order books, and then you have these decentralized AMMs, right? So, you know, I'd love to kind of have you comment a little bit on sort of the core technology, things around fairness and fair ordering, and, you know, really, really talk about kind of some of the juicy, nerdy stuff.
Yeah, for sure. So let's take the fairness one first, because I think that's a really important thing. And it kind of applies whether you're using an order book or an AMM or anything else. If someone knows what you're trying to do and can get ahead of you, they can take advantage of that to basically screw you out of some of your money and economic value that you would have got from that trade.
Front running, yes.
Falling, front running, exactly. And there's sort of basic front running, and then there's the more sophisticated MEV attacks and some of the weird stuff that goes on in the Ethereum mempool. But in general, it's just a bad idea to kind of have a transparent mempool and then order transactions by fee, because that allows that front running. But that also has another really sort of annoying or you know, negative effect, which is that if you've got a sort of race to extract this MEV, you're going to be willing to pay up to the amount that you can extract in order to get your transaction in. So that pushes fees up because everyone starts competing for position in the mempool in order to get that advantage. And, you know, really that's a bit of a non-starter, I think, for financial applications that kind of work in real time or near enough to it. And so, you know, on the Vega side, we developed a protocol called Wendy, which is a consensus layer pre-protocol that says rather than ordering transactions by fee, we actually try and order them in the order they arrived. And we can prove that happens under the same assumptions that you make with a proof of stake network. We can prove that that's a fair ordering. And that gives you a much better chance of creating a fair marketplace that's still decentralized.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this idea because just to give the audience a feeling, one of the things I've been really feeling is I've been really feeling the biological metaphor for DeFi, right? Which is that in a sense, I think of TVL almost like kilocalories of energy, right? And so in a sense, when you think about it almost from a predatory perspective, right, then these contracts basically become organisms. And if you take a predatory approach to these contracts, then you can like either, you know, suck their blood out like a mosquito, or you could just tear them apart and eat them like a wolf, right? So, you know, the thing that's very interesting is that, you know, when you put in a large order, for example, it's a little bit like throwing a big pile of like meat on the ground to see who comes to get this energy, right? To who gets, you know, and in a sense, there's this gap of time, right? So the thing that's so interesting about what you're describing, you know, almost from an emotional perspective, is that, you know, you have a queuing system, right? You have a thing where it's like, oh, you arrived first, take a number, or, you know, so you're really creating order instead of this free-for-all, right? Instead of this kind of like chaos where like squirrels are running in and they're really fast and like tigers are big and strong, you know, and all, it's just sort of this, instead of madness, you kind of have this kind of order.
Absolutely. And I, you know, that's really one of the really interesting sort of ways I think about this decentralized kind of movement, if you like, as well, which is the idea that what we're doing with these protocols is we are creating a way to have order without kind of government, if you like. It's kind of a way to create workable anarchy, right? You effectively, you remove the need for this like gatekeeper, this government, this person who controls what everyone's doing by creating a protocol that says, this is how this works. If you participate in this, this is how it'll work, and you know that's going to be fair. And effectively what happens is you kind of, on the fringes of that, like in the Ethereum mempool, you kind of don't have the protocol working in the way that you want. You're not able to say, this is what fair means, because the Ethereum blockchain doesn't let you define fair for that, because it's already defined by the blockchain and it's unfair. And so what we've said is actually we have different requirements for what is fair in order to kind of create this workable anarchy. And that's what the Wendy protocol allows us to do.
Yeah, I, you know, it's very interesting, right? Because I think you're using the word anarchy, which has kind of social coloring. And in a way, one of the ways that you can kind of deflect that is by using a word like anarchism, right? So if you use a word like anarchism, then you kind of are kind of talking about the early work of like Kropotkin and like, you know, some of the anarchist theorists who aren't proposing that people are stabbing each other in the streets, right? That they're proposing this kind of like higher order where, you know, things are fair and you know, that things work out really nicely, right? That's more like the theory of, right, of anarchism. But, you know, I think the thing that's interesting about, you know, this thing is that there's also an impact not just to fairness, but also to efficiency, right? And I think that's a really interesting thing, right? Because I think typically when people get fairness into their minds, they kind of suddenly get stuck with the idea of inefficiency, right? Like, for example, if you think about like the criminal justice system, right? You know, you think, okay, well, there's an attempt for fairness, but it comes with this inefficiency, right? Where it's sort of like, oh, they're applying, you know, these penalties, but they're doing it in a haphazard way, right? So they're trying to be fair, they're failing at it, and then they're also very bureaucratic and inefficient, right? But I think that what you're describing is something that has fairness and like an improvement in efficiency over existing systems. So I'd love to kind of hear you talk a little bit about efficiency. But maybe you said, I think you said start with fairness. So you may have another topic too to jump into.
Yeah, no, I think you know, fairness is a good one. I mean, you mentioned AMMs and order books, and actually,
yeah,
you know, AMMs and order books probably also come to the efficiency question, because actually, you know, the goal of a market is efficiency, really, right? You know, the goal of a market, well, it's to enable the trading, firstly. Yeah. So, you know, in general, if two people are interested in a trade that works for them both, like if I'm willing to buy some stocks for $10 and you're willing to sell them for $10 or less, then the ideal world, that trade would happen, right? The ideal world would not put an impediment to that trade going on, because it's better. Everyone ends up better off. And you know, so that's the goal of this stuff. And the goal is to do that, therefore, as efficiently as possible. So, you know, and that efficiency can be, how much does it cost to do that? Is there a fee? It can be, how quickly can I find you and exchange stocks or whatever it is we're buying? But it can also be, how well do we determine the price? Like, you know, if I'm willing to pay up to $50 just for stocks, but you're willing to sell them for anywhere above $5, what's the right price for them? And if you've got an AMM curve, it takes no information about the people who are wanting to buy and sell right now into account. It just takes information about how many stocks do I have and how many dollars do I have, and what function am I using? And so now I know theoretically the price for the socks. So it's very dumb. It's taking none of the information into account. And that's inefficient because it means all those people, all the sock sellers and sock buyers who in a limit order book would be telling you what their view of the price is. They're telling you, they're providing that information for free to the exchange. They're saying, this is my limit price. All of that information is not taken into account by the dumb curve. So in that sense, the curve is way less efficient than the order book. But the downside of that is someone has to provide a price. So if I'm providing liquidity to the curve, to an order book, I have to sit there and work out a price. And I probably have a machine and a server and some data feeds and an office, and that costs money. So if it's a super low liquidity market, is it actually worth that cost to supply the one guy who wants to buy socks a day? Is it actually better off to use the curve and say, well, the price is less efficient, but the cost of providing the price is basically zero? And so you end up in this situation where actually they're both useful tools. And the ideal situation is a hybrid market where you can kind of have passive liquidity that's algorithmically calculated, and you can have active liquidity that's priced, and you can move automatically between the two. If no one wants to price it right now, you've got a curve and you've got a pool.
Yep.
If people do want to buy pricing information, then you get better pricing. And so then you get back to the efficiency argument. You have a market like that, which has the opportunity to be as efficient as possible and to move between the mode where efficient means rapidly good pricing in a liquid market and where efficient means cheap to run.
Yeah, I love that distinction, right? Because I really was taking a super linear view of efficiency, and I think you've really dimensionalized it beautifully, right? Which is it is efficient to do both, and it must be. I mean, one of the ways that I reason about AMM versus CLOB or central limit order book is that I think of AMM like fish sex. Right. So like, you know, and it's not all fish do this, but some fish basically lay eggs and then they just go away. Right. And then at some point, so the eggs are just sitting there on the riverbed or whatever. And then a male fish comes along and fertilizes them later. Right. So the eggs are just sitting there for no reason. Right. And in a sense, that's AMM. Right. Which is you just leave your eggs lying there, you know, for no reason, you know, and then they just sit there for however long it takes. Right. So, you know, but the thing that you're describing that makes a ton of sense is that it's basically makes sense in these kind of low liquidity, you know. And the thing that's interesting is the derivatives markets, you know, are not monolithic. They're just highly super fragmented into billions of weird, obscure products, right? So in a sense, those all become lower liquidity. I mean, obviously, there's some crazily popular ones, you know, that are like simple Bitcoin derivatives and things like that. But like, you know, ultimately, you're talking about like a potentially infinite number of products. So like, you know, you can see where the fish sex paradigm may work better than getting Alice and Bob in real time type of
thing. Yeah, no, for sure. And in fact, you know, even at that point, it's got to be worth your while to leave the eggs there, and you're going to get some return. And in fact, you fall off the bottom of that scale, and you get to the point where even AMMs won't be efficient enough use of capital. And you start to think about sort of bespoke, almost like OTC markets, where it's almost like an RFQ, where I design a product and I basically go out to the marketplace. I place something on a blockchain that says, hey, I would like to buy one of these or 10 of these. And this is my definition of the product. And someone in an institution somewhere actually goes and prices that up and gives you a price.
Yeah. A great example of that is something like a secondary market forward contract, right? So you can have someone who's, you know, an individual person who has an individual specific lockup on an individual token, and then they're selling the forward contract on that. That's a market of one, right? There's only one of those.
And in a weird way, it connects into the whole NFT thing, because effectively a market of one is kind of an NFT, right?
Lovely.
So it's a bespoke instrument. It's basically an NFT.
Beautiful. And at that point, you start to get into almost like B2B commerce, right? You get into these really, really interesting scenarios where someone's selling a software license, or they're selling, you know, could be selling anything,
a record album. The other cool thing you can obviously do is you can go the other direction as well. You can go, well, I got this software license, this B2B thing, this individual product, this derivative, but it was actually worth $1 billion and it was done by this company. So the next thing to do is to then actually split it up and turn it into an infinitely divisible token.
Yeah, you can financialize it.
Portions of it.
Yes. It's all incredibly beautiful, right? Because in a sense, the purpose of derivatives is really to kind of optimize the risk exposure of capital, right? And to create these kind of beautifully, perfectly optimized risks according to different theses, right?
Yeah, it's a term that's used a lot in VCs, is like the concept, you know, when VCs talk about bundling and unbundling.
Yeah.
Derivatives are about unbundling risk. They're about going, my portfolio, my business, whatever, has all of these risks, and I want to unbundle this one and get rid of it,
I love
or
it. I love
I
it.
want to acquire it because I believe it's mispriced and I can make money.
I think
But derivatives are
yes.
unbundling risk.
I love that because in a sense, what you're talking about is you're talking about the perfect world of math and the imperfect, messy world that we all live in, you know. And so I think that's kind of the idea, right? Which is you can kind of
Yeah,
get those to fit better together.
you build more specific tools that help you deal with the world in a better place. You know, sure, if everything's a if everything if the only thing you got a hammer is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But once you buy a proper toolkit, you can do more. And it's the same sort of thing. You know, sure, I can trade very, very non-specific products that kind of give me a hedge or kind of give me an edge in a market. But actually, when I can look at individual risks in the world and see what's mispriced, I can optimize better. And then you get back to efficiency. The better you do at this trading of risk and unbundling a risk and trading it and pricing it, the more efficient the financial and the business world becomes. Because, maybe a farmer is not the best person to try and understand the weather. Maybe they just want to make sure the weather doesn't hurt their revenue, and someone else can price that risk better, and so they take out a derivative. And
Beautiful.
that's the magic of this. You move the things to the place where they can be best dealt with.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So I guess what I'd love to kind of get it, obviously if there's other topics, please jump in, but I think that how I usually ask how things are going, right? So in terms of like, are there any kind of ways of quantifying this kind of progress? Like, where are we in the journey of Vega?
We're really early. I mean, we're actually we have a sort of public test net live, and we're about to launch an incentivized test net as well. So we're going to start to get sort of more real world trading activity because people have incentives to do better things. So we're at that point, and we're live just with cash settled futures at the moment. But the liquidity mining protocol just went live this last week, actually, the first version of it. So yeah, we're moving along pretty nicely. Later this year, we will get our first mainnet sort of mainnet ready version of the protocol. It'll be what we're kind of calling the Wild West net. So we know it's going to be risky early days. Like, it's a new network, a new blockchain. So it's going to be there's going to be limits on the size of things people can do with it. But the goal will be to prove it works and sort of scale it up from there. And that'll be coming, in the next few months.
That's tremendous and profoundly exciting. So that's great to hear. So I guess would love to kind of get kind of maybe even more of the juicy details. I don't know if you have other kind of hobby horse topics to jump into, but I just want to open the floor a bit because I know you've got so many great things to add.
Yeah, sure. Let's think. So I think actually liquidity mining is another really interesting sort of side topic on all of this. Like, how do you reward liquidity? And one of the
Yes.
problems we have right now is that, well, there are probably two problems. The first one, or maybe even three. Actually, I'm going to go with three.
Yes.
So the first one of these problems is that there's a lot of sort of captive capital because DeFi kind of turned up. Before that, a lot of people just hold crypto because they're long crypto, right? If you hold Bitcoin, you hold the Ether, then any yield is better than no yield, and you definitely want to still hold Ether because you think it's going to go up versus the dollar. So you're kind of stuck in this place where you've got this captive stuff. So people will use, basically anything giving you yield. The next problem is that a bunch of that yield is subsidized either by VC money or by currently being able to issue tokens a hand over fist and it not seeming to, to impact the price too much. And so you end up with this situation where you have yields that are probably not going to be sustainable. And then, and that really just means that you don't know what the real price for liquidity should be. You know, we're trying
Yes.
to create a marketplace for liquidity. You don't really know what the price is. And then a lot of the protocols like Uniswap and others often have quite simplistic fee schemes where perhaps the fee is the same on every market. And that doesn't really make sense to me. Like, if I've got a market which has got 1.3 billion TVL, you could probably argue it might not need that. So why has it got the same fee? Why has it got the same reward attracting people into it as a market which is actually not really got enough TVL versus the people number of people trying to
That's
trade?
super
So
important.
you actually need to get much more smart with that stuff. And we need market-driven fees. So effectively, and again, that's one of the features of Vega is when you commit liquidity, Vega has a target liquidity stake, and that's basically driven by the amount of open interest in the market and the amount of trading. If that target is not being met or is only just being met, then you're in a position where you can effectively come in as a liquidity provider and set the fee. If the target is being met, then effectively the fee is chosen by, what the lowest fee is that covers the target from the liquidity providers who are committed. And that effectively means that there's an incentive to reduce fees over time so that as a market gets liquid, the fees get lower because people are making plenty of money off of the off of the fees happening all the time as people are trading in and out. And as a market's less liquid, the fees can be higher in order to make sure enough liquidity is attracted to service the needs. So, that's a really nice little thing, but it's really important in the long run, because just going out, the fees are 0.3% or whatever, means that, when people are looking at BitMEX or, other centralized platforms and looking at the fees there, then they're going to be attracted to those more. And so you need to be able to cope with both the low liquidity, high fee scenario and the other one.
That's very exciting, and I think one of the really interesting things is just looking at something like a Uniswap, right? Which is, really, I think the largest DeFi and largest Ethereum application, so it's obviously a tremendous achievement and, really wonderful, DeFi utility. But I guess from the perspective of kind of improvement, tell me a bit about, one of the things that we chatted about earlier was about kind of like this Uniswap V3 range capability, right? So in a sense, people are able to set ranges of prices, so that kind of helps with efficiency, right? So I guess what are your thoughts about, some of these newer capabilities, and how in some sense, like AMM is moving closer to the central limit order book?
Yeah, and it's really interesting, actually. I think, I remember certainly, early in the days of Uniswap, there were a lot of, and once when it started to see success, there were sort of a lot of noise out of the Uniswap site. AMMs can do anything an order book can do. You don't need order books. And so they find themselves in this weird position now where I feel like they're kind of screaming out, what we really want is an order book. But on the one hand, Ethereum can't really support efficient order books given the sort of the high gas fees and the slow speed of the network. And on the other hand, they probably don't want to necessarily admit, actually, we might be better off with an order book then.
I think the thing that has always been a bother, right, is that, crypto Twitter and others have been kind of bad at naming things, right? So I think that people have equated DEX with AMM, and in a sense, they've had these funny experiences like EtherDelta and like IDEX and these other things that actually have centralized central limit order books. And so the thing that's a question that's interesting is that, I think what you're talking about is more like a decentralized central limit order book, which is almost like a, so in a sense, the idea of a decentralized exchange is already kind of a broken concept. So like, but I guess, is it possible to have a decentralized central limit order book? And, or is that a fair or is that a very weird description of it?
No, it's 100% possible. I mean, I don't know whether you can still call it a central limit order book, but it's certainly a limit order book. And that's exactly how Vega works. Like every single node replicates a copy of it. The key really, one of the keys to an order book, but I mean, you can have an order book at the kind of speed of Ethereum, but it's not as much fun if you like.
No.
It sort of loses some of the benefit.
Yes.
Certainly from a human UI point of view, the genius of Uniswap is that if something's only going to happen once every 15 seconds, you want it to be, I'm done with my trade now. You don't really get the same sort of interactive experience as a centralized exchange. With Vega, we've kind of implemented a proof of stake with immediate finality and a sort of 800 millisecond to 1 second block time. So using it feels a bit like using a centralized exchange. In fact, I remember using Poloniex back in the day when it had some scaling trouble, and it would take longer than Vega does to process your transaction quite often. So, we're now well into the realm of usable limit order book on a decentralized system, and that suddenly just opens up the solution space. I think when you're stuck in the world where a useful limit order book is not really possible, you're going to do the best you can with an AMM. But we have the wonderful ability to look at what everyone's doing with their AMMs and the amazing innovation. And there's a lot of good stuff happening. And actually, I was initially so skeptical of AMMs, I thought they were kind of pointless for anything. And the more I dug into what people were doing, I looked at Bancor early on, and it was kind of expensive on the fees and not great at the time. And they've improved it since. But, I'd kind of just dismissed the AMM thing as a fad that would go away. And then the innovation and things that, Hayden and Uniswap and others managed to do, really showed that there's a place for them, but I think they're also constrained. And so when we were able to say, well, we've now got a much bigger solution space, we can do a limit order book and start there, but we can also integrate a kind of hybrid model where there's going to be AMM liquidity and limit orders existing in the same market, coexisting, in fact.
Yeah, so I like that. So I guess instead of trying to go for like C lob or D lob or it's really just a lob, And the thing that I think is the Gordian knot here, though, is that this kind of binary polarity, right? Because people talk about DEX, and that's it. Just seems like a really wrongheaded conversation to be having. So can you kind of comment on other approaches, right? So we talk about kind of like Bancor and kind of these very originally pure AMMs that are kind of starting to slide closer to the cloud model, right? But, you know, obviously there's so many approaches, right? So if you look at like Binance Smart Chain, obviously FTX, Solana, like, you know, there's just these different kinds of new clusters of people, you know, trying to attack this problem. So I guess I'd love to kind of hear your thoughts about these different experiments.
Yeah, and there's a few different ways these things categorize up, I suppose. So, you know, from one hand, it's kind of what's the approach to trading, and actually, you know, one which we are probably will support within a couple of months of launch is the idea of the frequent batch auction. So that's kind of it's a bit like a limit order book, but instead of instantly executing things, you actually collect orders for a period of time and then you sort of put them into an auction together. And that can help with things like front running, and it can help for fair price discovery, especially in slightly less liquid markets. So that's something we're exploring. There's great research out of Chicago Booth University about the value of that versus limit order books. So that's one side of things in terms of approach. And then the other side is kind of like, how do you integrate with the ecosystem? You know, so you've got the Ethereum purist side of things, which is attractive, except for the fact that you have all those constraints of the network. And you start to look at the L2s, and then each of the L2s has different trade-offs. You have L2s where they're very fast, but they're very, very constrained computationally or in terms of what kind of algorithms you can run. You have L2s where I think the optimistic roll-ups maybe, where you basically have like a week to submit a fraud proof, which means you can't get your money out for a week. And again, that's not great. So you get all these different trade-offs. And one of the things we did was say, well, let's just build a network that's optimized for trading. So the trade-off is you can't do other stuff with it. Like the trade-off is it's only for trading, but it's really, really good at trading. And that allows us to do a whole bunch of things. Like, you know, one of the interesting things is the bridges people are building. So, you know, the bridges to do, say, wrapped BTC, and to do that in a decentralized way.
Yeah.
The problem with those bridges is you've got to pay for them, right? So if I've got a network and all it's doing is got my BTC sat on it, somehow those node operators have got to get paid, otherwise they're just going to steal your BTC. So the problem there is now I'm paying, you know, my gas fees on Ethereum, and I'm paying these guys to look after my Bitcoin. So, you know, one of the advantages Vega has is it's cross-chain by nature, and it can integrate across bridges with multiple chains, but it has trading on it, and all of the transactions on it generate trading fees. So securing the bridged assets is paid for by the trading fees, which are the reason the assets are bridged. So you kind of get a cheaper and, again, more efficient way to do bridges. So, you know, we've taken that thing in Vega and really run with it on the idea that we only really want the Vega protocol to be good at trading derivatives and trading in spot as well in futures. We only want it to be able to do that. We don't want to do asset issuance. People issuing assets, ERC-20 is great. Issue them on Ethereum and then bridge them to Vega, or issue them on Polkadot, or issue them on Terra. So, you know, we really see it as kind of like, we want this protocol to be amazingly good at this one thing, and it to plug into the ecosystem. Like if you want to do lending, use Compound or, you know, one of the others. But, you know, instead of trying to do everything, instead of trying to build a general purpose thing, we want to be amazingly good at this one thing and then leverage the ecosystem and the community that's already there for the other stuff.
Yeah, it's really nice. And I think having a nucleus of fair ordering really kind of is transformative, right? Because I think when you talk about this, we're definitely kind of getting a little closer to, you know, one place to hunt for solutions is to look at existing derivatives infrastructure in the decentralized space, right? So obviously you start to look at the pairs like Synthetics and Optimism, which I think you alluded to, you know, by talking about things like general purpose L2, right? But then you kind of look at other solutions, you know, I think Rune is interesting, and I don't know what your thoughts are about that, but like, you know, Rune obviously is now working with Shapeshift, so that becomes kind of almost an exchange paradigm. You know, and then you have kind of, you know, a variety of other solutions like UMA. So, you know, I'd love to kind of maybe get you to trawl around in there. You know, I think you already talked a little bit about general purpose layer two, but there's, you know, I obviously the Thor chain stuff is also very intriguing.
Yeah, that's very interesting for sure. You know, the first thing I would say is, you know, there's that one category of things, which is this sort of weird, uneasy marriage between centralized exchanges and their huge amounts of money and revenue and their exchange tokens and then blockchains and things. So, you know, Serum and FTX and Binance and Binance Chain. And you know, I like you even can start to see that this, you know, this pollutes the purity, if you like, of these things. But like, you know, Binance and the way they sort of funnel you towards Binance Chain when you withdraw things, and the kind of the dark patterns they use to try and try and bootstrap adoption of DeFi on their chain. And it's really, what's the point? It's a centralized chain. Like, why bother? Just stay on the centralized exchange if that's what you wanted, you know? So I think they're quite cynical attempts at just trying to make sure that, like, if DeFi takes off, which it has, that they get some of that pie.
And yeah, Binance feels that way to me as well.
Yeah, that's how it feels. And I don't think that's... The problem is that eventually the regulation will catch up with the things that are centrally controlled anyway. And so their regulatory arbitrage isn't going to be working, and they're not giving you the benefits of decentralization and truly open access. So I don't know why exist. So, you know, I really think this sort of the DeFi and the decentralization is what we want to go for. And, you know, you mentioned Uma, and I think, you know, I met the guys at Uma, and I think they're a really, really smart team. And I'm interested to see what they do in terms of like scaling and scaling up, because the big problem that you have with derivatives when you're trying to build a protocol is capital efficiency. You know, when you do spot, it's okay. Yeah. It's like, if it doesn't matter how long, if I wait 10 seconds or a minute, I can probably get over it. I want to buy this token. I put my money and I get the token. If I'm doing a derivatives trade, either to make money or to hedge, like the difference between, you know, what is it on synthetics, like 7 times over collateralized or whatever, however, you know, the difference between 7 times over collateralized and you need to put up 5% of the notional value is the difference between not even reading past the first page of the website and using it as a core part of your business day in, day out.
Yes.
And, you know, to me is the big sticking point for this. A lot of these kind of approaches is, how do you get capital efficiency out? And, you know, that requires a couple of things. It requires being able to design products with sort of full features, and it requires the sort of computational capacity to manage risk properly. You know, and one of the approaches that's really common in Ethereum, and I don't think it's a smart thing to do, but I think it's kind of something you're forced to do, or one of the few options available on the constrained blockchains, is the kind of the idea of like liquidation auctions. It's like, this guy might own more money than they actually have, but the network actually doesn't have a way or can't afford to calculate that, right? That's what a liquidation auction is. It's saying the protocol can't afford to work out if everyone who has a position, you know, has blown through their margin or not. So it's basically saying someone else somewhere needs to be doing that, and then they need to submit a transaction. And, you know, at the end of that, maybe you've managed to close this position out. But, you know, really that's not efficient, because every time the price changes, like when I do a trade and I set a new price, you can mark that to market. You can see whether everyone owes more money, you know, soon on BitMEX or something like that. As soon as the price moves, the exchange checks who now owes more than they should. I'll close them immediately. The information is all there.
Yeah.
So it's never going to make sense to need someone else in a third party to take that information that came from the protocol, do that calculation, and then put a request back into the protocol to liquidate people. Because that's always going to be less efficient. That's always going to be more risky. And therefore, it's always going to require more margins. You're always going to have this capital efficiency problem. And that's why you need the capability of certainly a faster, more capable chain.
Yeah, but I think faster is funny, right? And the reason why I say faster is funny, right, is, you know, I was in a chat with Sam Bankman-Fried, and one of his things was MEV goes towards zero as you get faster, right? So in a sense, I think his attitude is kind of in the mood of like, you know, you don't need to outrun the bear, you just outrun all the other people nearby, you know? And so in a sense, like, he's trying to outrun MEV, right? And I think that, you know, it does relate to efficiency, right? But to me, the thing that's so funny is even Klob isn't even Klob, right? In the sense that, like, you know, I had a dinner with Jeff Sprecher of the ICE exchange, right? And if you look at the New York Stock Exchange, it turns out that you can rent a rack next to the New York Stock Exchange rack. And it's not even an office building nearby. It's actually the rack next door. And you can actually get liquid nitrogen cooled crossbar between the sort of 24 inch span between the two racks, you know. So it turns out that, like, you know, obviously it's super expensive to get that, but, you know, it's obviously worth it, right? So in a sense, like, you know, what you're talking about with fare ordering is in a way sort of even dealing with things like the speed of light problem that already exists in, you know, because obviously it takes light about a nanosecond to travel a foot, right? So, you know, and obviously, like, you know, going through metal media, it's slower, right? But I guess it's, you know, I'm still trying to kind of push on this, you know, because even a club isn't always a club. So I guess I
well, yeah, no, and you know, and the thing that SBF said is, you know, MEV tends to zero as you get faster. It tends there, but it doesn't get there because you never get infinitely
fast. Yeah. It's like it's Einsteinian.
And what that means is that the closer to zero it is, the richer you have to be to take advantage. So you know, what you end up with is if you just accept that MEV is there and just try and get faster, then all you're doing is going, hey, you know, you call hedge funds that used to pay to locate next to the NICE's
Flash
servers.
Boys.
Yeah, so instead of doing that, you're just going to be extracting MEV, but the chain is fast.
You're
so
building the old system.
Only the same funds get to take advantage. Different game, same winners, right?
Yep, totally agree.
The whole point of Wendy and fair ordering, and even things like you know, frequent batch auctions and things, and other innovations in how to run markets, is that it needs to be fair in a way that's recognizably fair to all the participants. Like, you know, you can say, like, it's like a game of football is fair as long as everyone's playing by the same rules. But an exchange isn't fair as long as everyone's playing by the same rules if those rules basically create a scenario where there's, like, you know, systematic discrimination.
Yes.
Kind of, you know, it's the same as a lot of the arguments about sort of systematic racism and other things. Like, if your system is set up so that some group of people are disadvantaged always for the other people to win, it doesn't matter if you're all paying by the same rules. It doesn't matter if the implementation of that system is fair, in quotes, because in effect, it's still set up in a way that advantages a certain group. And that's what we're really trying to do, is say we want it to be recognizably fair to all the participants.
That's a beautiful thing. And it's suggests to me that at some point, the fairness ordering technologies, you know, written in the white paper, you know, may end up actually being implemented in global exchange markets, you know, at scale, right? That you know, things like NASDAQ and New York Stock Exchange, right? From a regulatory perspective, like, it makes sense for the governments of the world to say that we need this level of fairness, right? Because I think this idea of, you know, in a sense, being the squirrel that's faster than the tiger and getting, you know, it being faster is, it shouldn't, you know, that's just a money game.
Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. And you know, the other way to think about it is from a, you know, from a sort of efficiency of markets and utility point of view. Again, you get back to that word efficiency. But, you know, if there's a bunch of people sat in London and New York and Greenwich and wherever else they sit in buildings with these massive funds, and all they're doing is taking advantage of the rules of a system to extract money from other people. Like, you know, there are people hedging, there are people doing things, you know, managing that risk. There's all this stuff going on. And all these people are doing is getting in the way of everyone else doing business and extracting money, right? Like, that's not very efficient. And as a government and a regulator, you shouldn't want that. You shouldn't want HFT funds extracting money with no socially useful value, right?
Yes.
You want people who have a better price for something. You want people who can better manage the risk to trade it. But you don't want people who are, like, you know, they're just doing the same as the exchange. They're rent seeking.
Yeah.
They're just rent seeking via arcane ways of abusing the rules rather than by running a server. And neither of those things is an efficient use of money if you can avoid it. Like,
yes. That's beautiful. It's beautiful. I think it's exciting. It's an exciting thing. So I guess one of the things I'm really interested to kind of have you tell folks is a little bit about the team and the superpowers, right? So, like, you know, obviously, you know, folks out in the world haven't met the Vega team. So, you know, would love to kind of have you shout out a few names and what their superpowers.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the Vega team is a varied bunch. And, you know, I'd say the kind of the key superpower across the board is that we've kind of combined some experience in how those markets really work and how they're designed, and how, you know, one of the crazy things I always think is true about sort of central about DeFi is that, you know, unlike some things which, you know, technology improves on, finance actually was full of incredibly smart people doing incredibly sophisticated and often good things to make trading better. And a lot of the kind of DeFi stuff kind of ignores a huge bunch of it. And so, you know, one of the things we did was we took a bunch of experience from there. You know, I spent a decade making building trading systems. David Siska, our sort of lead quant, he was a quant during the BNP Paribas during the 2007-2008 financial crisis. He's
exciting.
Worked on, you know, quantitative risk systems and things like that his whole life, but also a lecturer and researcher in financial maths at Edinburgh University, and he works on our quant libraries, on our risk stuff, and that allows for the efficiency that we can do by having those sophisticated risk models. So he's been a fantastic member of the team. We have Tamlin, who was an experienced derivatives trader, so she spent 15 years trading energy derivatives, so she's been on the team making sure that when we design things, we design them in a way that makes sense for traders, and sort of having that trader's mind, and helping with the sort of the community of traders and all of that as well. So she's a fantastic asset to the team in that respect. We have some serial entrepreneurs. Ramsey, my co-founder, he founded Chainspace with a group of people, which ended up sort of exiting in a pretty decent way to Facebook, and a bunch of other stuff that he's done in the sort of investing space. So he's really brought that entrepreneurial ability. There's really just a great range of technologists, and Klaus is probably the other person to mention. So, we've talked a lot about Wendy and the fair ordering. Klaus was writing papers and building sort of consensus systems and working on these kind of problems actually even before Bitcoin came around and the Bitcoin white paper. It's just that at the time it was this kind of stuffy academic topic that no one thought had much real world application, and Bitcoin added the last bits to make that so. And so Klaus has designed the Wendy protocol and the staking system for Vega and a bunch of other stuff, and is unbelievably talented.
Wow. Yeah, I definitely am excited about an all-star team and, incredibly diverse but super deep talent, vertical domain knowledge, and, the complete package. So, it's great to hear. I guess one of the questions that I like to ask, and I think we've already touched this actually, is the sort of the big idea. Right. So I think, but I just wanted to give it to you directly. Right. Which is sort of, how do you see this story arc and the big idea and the unfolding of this? I mean, I think you've touched it on, the total size of DeFi and the derivatives and financial industry. But I guess give it to me straight.
Yeah, sure. And there's a few things that go on here. There's the kind of building better, more interconnected global markets and liquidity, so. That's certainly kind of, it's almost a parallel of what the internet did for information, doing, completing that job for value and trading. I think that's a huge thing. The ability to have permissionless innovation and to have it happen where the need arises as well is just something that's going to be totally new. Right now, if you're sat in most countries in the world, to be honest, if you're creating new businesses and new value, if you're doing things that have never been done before, and you start to come across a risk, that is very, very hard to get someone to create a bespoke derivatives product that does what you need. But now you will be able to connect to anyone anywhere in the globe who's doing similar things and create those products, and suddenly open up that ability, that ability to do things. And then the final piece of the puzzle is kind of like, the sort of second wave of the internet, and as Andreessen Horowitz always say, the software is eating the world. And by making all this stuff automated and software driven and removing sort of the humans from the equation, if you like, of how the platforms run, you also make it programmable. So at the moment we're sort of saying, people are going to come along and create a market that they want, but in future you can actually say software is going to come along and create a market that it wants. Software that does things is going to say, well, I'm initiating this thing, so I'm going to create and request, especially when you talk about those kind of, bespoke contracts, the NFT like derivatives where there's only one of them. You could literally imagine, you could start a road trip across the US, and you're paying to charge up your electric car. You could imagine creating a contract, the car automatically creating a contract to hedge the price of electricity and allowing you to pay for the charging up front. And you don't even know that's happened, but in the background, the way that it can give you a price for charging up front is by creating a derivative that hedges that price over the course of the trip. And so suddenly you get to this point where it's not people creating markets and launching them and trading together. It's actually software creating markets, and this kind of world where effectively what you get is just better risk management for everyone and a more efficient world and better things. And there's a great, early pre-example of this, if you like, because it doesn't use this tech, but you can buy seeds that include weather derivatives. And the farmer doesn't know it includes weather derivatives, but what they know is if there's a crop failure and the temperature goes below a certain level, the manufacturer of the seeds will pay them out based on how many seeds they bought for what that crop would have been worth.
I love it.
That's just built into those seeds, but that's okay. The giant multinational can buy those derivatives on their trading desk and offer that product. This will allow the same people in their bedrooms coding up new systems to embed that kind of risk management into things that they're building and products.
I love it.
Just sort of opens it all up.
I love it. You know, in a way, it's taking this beautiful, mathematical, perfect world, and it's sort of superimposing some of those principles on the kind of janky, messy, complicated, black swanny world that we live in, you know, and it's yeah. very nice, right? So I think that's a beautiful, and it kind of links in some ways the idea of sort of insurance with the idea of sort of derivatives. Yeah,
and
it's
the
very
last
lovely.
Sort of thing, example I would give is, I don't know if you remember, in the first sort of beginning of the dot-com boom, if you wanted to start a new company, you needed servers. You needed racks and servers and Oracle licenses and all that stuff. So yeah. like the cost of a startup was high, right? There was a big deal. Now you go write some code into your favorite text editor, push a button. It's probably free as a startup, but even if it's not free, it's like $5 a month and you can create a service and integrate Stripe and everything. And yep. it's that those toolkits that let anyone do it and make it super cheap. And you know, this is one of the things we're building. We're building these toolkits for finance to kind of rip it out of the hands of the banks and the exchanges and say everyone can do it now.
That's beautiful. And, you know, I think fairness at this kind of fundamental level is super exciting. I think the decentralization at the fundamental level, super exciting. I totally agree that there's some kind of disingenuous kind of centralized exchange types of approaches to, you know, dealing with some of these problems, you know, but it really only addresses things like inefficiency and it doesn't address things like fairness. So, you know, I think it's definitely just recreating the old systems.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, you know, this has been super exciting. Super happy to have you on the show and obviously welcome back anytime, especially, you know, I know you have super exciting milestones with incentivized testnet and mainnet coming up. So, you know, we'd love to keep track of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to come back and maybe talk about and show you some of the stuff that we do as we get close to launch.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks so much.
Brilliant. Thank you.